It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. All right, thank you for tuning into the It's Going Down podcast. We're joined with three people that are going to be speaking about the new school occupation happening in New York. It's in regards to a group of cafeteria workers that are fighting for a new contract. For the past several days, people have been occupying the cafeteria of the university, and there's been various protests and pickets that are going on. We're going to be talking with these individuals about what exactly is happening. So can you all just introduce yourselves?
So I'm Salim.
I'm Mia.
And I'm Jasper.
And then just for those that don't know, what is the New School exactly?
So New School is a private university in New York City. It was founded during World War II as a refuge for exiled Jewish academics from Germany. And it started with very openly radical communist and anarchist kind of politics. Anti-fascism is one of the founding core values of New School, as is the abolition of capital.
Yeah.
That said, the New School is now one of the worst neoliberal hellholes in anywhere. So.
Yeah. I mean, the New School was founded by, I think, six professors from Columbia who didn't want to take a loyalty oath, and so they started their own thing.
Right.
But it's strayed quite far from that.
That's very interesting, and we could do a whole podcast on itself. I'm just because that is so interesting. Does anybody want to say anything? The drift from anti-capitalist Marxism, socialism to this finite what's seen as kind of a upper echelon neoliberal institution.
I mean, I think there's still very much a lot of that strain of thinking has continued in terms of the professors at the school. There's still mm-hmm. A lot of prominent Marxist thinkers at the school, but I think the administration has just gone the way of all private colleges in the U.S. And a lot of that, apparently, from what I've heard, has come with the acquisition of Parsons,
the design school.
Yeah. And they took on the business model of Parsons very strongly, mm-hmm. and Parsons is a design school, but it's also management and business type yeah. school for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it also could probably speak to the impossibility of maintaining those very radical founding values mm-hmm. within the institution of higher education, within a capitalist society. I just don't think that's
definitely
right. Totally. So, how did this occupation start? What happened? What kicked it off?
Well, so the Communist Student Group, which is this MLM reading group on campus, which has been around since around Trump's election, I guess, they started doing essentially a lot of flyering and a lot of agitation on campus around the cafeteria workers, who are all being en masse let go as their contract was expiring, and the New School is attempting to bring cafeteria services in-house, so not from a third-party corporation, which would allow the school to cut down on costs and rehire the workers without their union and without all their pay and benefits and without even all of the workers.
Right. I mean, they would be replacing most of the workers with student workers who would be paid lower wages and who would not be receiving benefits. So that would be a huge part of the way in which they were cutting costs by firing all of the workers.
Yeah. Initially, when they notified the union about the mass layoffs, they basically told them, we don't expect that any of these workers will reapply for their jobs. And we, you know, they're welcome to, but there's no guarantees as to whether or not they would have them. And if they did have them, you know, it was expected that their wages and benefits would be slashed.
Mm-hmm.
So how did the relationship between the workers and the cafeteria begin with those that are now supporting the occupation? How did that whole interplay begin?
I think there was, for some students on campus, had been organizing a bit with the union that represents the workers, doing like some leafleting and some like small event disruptions. And some of us got to know the workers through that organizing. I think the communist student group, the Maoist group on campus, just kind of approached workers and talked to them. Yeah.
It's a good model, just approaching people.
Yeah, definitely a good model.
You know, when did this start, and just how did it actually begin? Was there just people were in the cafeteria and just announced that it was going to be occupied? There's been like photos, and this is on May Day too. This started, but just kind of talk about if you can just on May Day how it all began.
So there was a meeting on Friday held by the Communist Student Group, the Friday before May Day, where essentially a few workers were present in this meeting, and all the students and workers who were present in the meeting basically decided to occupy the cafeteria on Tuesday, May Day, at 11:30 a.m. And then I think the Communist Student Group sort of just mobilized a lot of people to flyer the whole school and stuff, and then ended up actually that on Tuesday at 11:30, a lot of students showed up from throughout the university. The whole cafeteria was like flooded with people, and it was probably around like 100 people were there at the very beginning. So that was sort of how it started. And then I think from then, it just sort of there became a sort of more consolidated group of maybe like 30 or so people who are consistently in the occupation, sort of adopting responsibilities. But
I mean, the initial time was maybe like 50 to 100 people flooding in.
Yeah.
And it was pretty great. People just started expropriating all the food that was in there.
Yep.
We started making sandwiches and smoothies along with the workers for each other.
Yeah.
Some people took the packaged food outside and started distributing it to the homeless. It was like a really amazing feeling, honestly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And we're going to talk a little bit about like what's become of the kitchen in a little bit, but I'm curious, how did the campus police respond to this, and how have they responded in the last week?
It's been a pretty lukewarm response from campus police, although they've had 1 to 3 officers, or I don't know if officer is the correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's more of a security force. But they've had a few people posted up at the occupation at all times. Yeah, you want us to them a
little
bit more?
Yeah, so I think people have been encouraged by these organizers to take a friendly approach to the campus security. There's a lot of faith placed in their position as workers. And I think that's come from the fact that like some of them have personally been friendly to us. I wouldn't have the same faith in that, just because I think they've been standing down from orders from the administration, and if mm-hmm. that changes, then it would be a radically different situation. But there's almost been a sense of complacency towards the campus security, which has been weird, but they've, like, most of them have also been generally chill to us.
Yeah, but I think a lot of us also realize that their personal sympathies really don't necessarily matter at all when it comes down to it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it true that people have been serving free food out of the cafe, like, in the last week? Has the cafe, like, still continued to function as a place where money is exchanged, or what does daily life within the occupied cafe look like?
So there's definitely no money, but
there's no money.
Well, we're not paying anybody for. I guess we acquire groceries, because one thing the administration did right away was they nailed down the door to the kitchen where there's like tons of food, and they started throwing it all out. But so we've been acquiring food through different means, mostly through donations and people's meal plans, which work off campus to some extent. And also some of the cafeteria work equipment has still been functional, although most of it's turned off. And the cafe serves free meals 3 times a day, pretty regularly.
And this is all coming from the occupation.
Yeah, there are no workers working in the cafeteria right now.
Yeah, it's entirely student-run, and it's open to anyone in on campus.
So I'm just a little bit confused. So the workers have already been laid off?
No.
No, but because of the occupation, they're unable to work in the cafeteria. They're still getting...
Oh.
But they don't come into work generally, unless they come to hang out with us.
Yeah, we've had...
You said they're still getting paid, though?
Yeah, they're still getting paid. And we've had a couple workers at the occupation, I think every day of the occupation.
Yeah,
standing with the occupiers. Today they brought us a cake, which was very nice.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. So basically the cafe has been occupied. The workers are getting paid, but they cannot work. But the cafe is still feeding people three times a day for free.
Yep, you got it.
Wow. What's that like? What is that experience like? Is it one of joy, or people are like, I got to go to the communal cafe and make people food? What's that like to do that three times a day?
I mean, I think it's a complicated issue just because it fundamentally concerns reproductive labor. So I think that there has been a lot of discussion around exactly who is doing the cooking and the cleaning. And I think that those are super important conversations to have, and they haven't always been handled gracefully by everyone in the group. So I think that, yeah, that's been like a little bit of a point of tension. But yeah, I mean, I guess aside from that, I think there is something joyous about seeing that it's like actually entirely within the realm of possibility to like provide food for like a huge group of people and like share meals with people and just like, it's a really nice feeling.
What is the student population that's coming into the cafe to get the free food? I mean, what is that interaction like? Like, it's been a week now, so people are used to the idea that you can go to this occupied cafe and there's going to be food there. Are people like, are they going there and like working on their schoolwork and like hanging out, or what does the scene look like inside the cafe?
I mean, inside the cafeteria, there's normally a solid group of there's at least five people. It's usually 5 to 15. I mean, it fluctuates, but there's always a group of people in there just hanging out and like reading or working on homework or something.
Yeah, I think spatially it's important to kind of lay out what the cafeteria is like, because there's a main cafeteria section, which was what was initially occupied, and that's where like the food service stations are and where the kitchen is.
Mm-hmm.
And then outside of that, there's like a larger seating area.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people who are coming to like the free cafeteria just to get food are kind of more in the seating area, whereas like occupiers take up both spaces. I don't know exactly what I'm trying to get at that, but there's some sort of, I don't know.
Yeah, I think what happens is that a lot of the people who are coming for food are also just working in the occupation or helping do stuff with the broader campaign for like the cafeteria workers being rehired.
Yeah, or like tonight we did a large food serve for all the graduate students who are on strike.
Yeah, so we invited the picket line into the occupied cafeteria and served them up there.
Oh, awesome. And that was people at Columbia?
No, so this is the student academic union that just got like recognized here at the New School. So that's SENS UAW, Student Employees of the New School, United Auto Workers.
Wow, that was cool. Do you want to share anything about that experience?
I mean, it was nice to see one of the lead organizers from SENS UAW kind of give their thanks and appreciation to the free cafeteria. And I don't know, it's definitely a nice way to build solidarity between these two movements that are happening simultaneously on campus.
I think more than that, though, today was the first day of the strike, and there's been a general feel, because a lot of actually occupiers are members of SENS, and also just because both of these issues are happening together and are, like, the academic workers are being screwed over in exactly the same way the cafeteria workers are, and the schools refusing to bargain with them both. Right. So there's been a general sense that if we can solidly unite both of these campaigns to shut the school down, that's our best bet at getting the administration to cave.
So just moving on, I wanted to switch gears towards, you know, there's a lot of different political ideologies and tendencies that are at play. As you mentioned, there's a Maoist group that's been involved since the beginning. Y'all are coming from anarchist or anti-state communist positions. Just kind of curious, like, how does this all mix, you know, together? Is it trying at times? People just kind of, you know, roll with their crew and that's about it and just try to make it work? Or what is it like putting all these different people together?
Well, I mean, I think it was interesting for me because this may sound tangential at first, but in my head it's related. I think within maybe the second or third day of the occupation, basically the inner structure of the occupation itself became like incredibly bureaucratized. So basically it was like there was a committee for every committee, and then the point people of those committees would in another committee. And it was just like very, just overly bureaucratized in my opinion. So I think the position that maybe I began to increasingly gravitate towards was that, like, even regardless of tendency, just I think I found myself sort of gravitating towards working with people who I trusted and felt comfortable with, and just sort of autonomously doing actions on our own without, you know, necessarily going through all of these various, like, structures set in place to mediate our actions, because ultimately I think they just ended up sort of limiting what was possible for people within the occupation to be actually accomplishing to further our goal.
Yeah, and I think the Maoists who are quote unquote in charge have been very loud about their political ideology and like being specifically Maoists and all of this mass line stuff that they believe in. And I think part of that is because these committees were essentially formed on the second day, because everybody had this idea in their heads that you need committees to get stuff done. And so this, essentially, like, this consensus structure of, like, these democratic, I guess, or quote-unquote democratic organizations led to, like, a centralized message being pushed out, which allowed, like, the Maoists to become the visible heads of the occupation. Mm. But I would say that most of the people here are not Maoists.
the vast majority.
There's really people from every sort of tendency. I think we even had a Posadist in here the other day.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big question for any of us, is just, like, how does our, you know, quote, ideology or set of ideas, like, is that something that we're, like, basically creating a brand around and we're trying to sell that along with the action, or is that something that, like, comes out of the action that we're doing and it's kind of more of something that we live, or is it both? And I mean, I think lots of people would have different answers to that.
I mean, I think for the communist student, they're very much trying to build a brand and, like, build a core or a mass movement or whatever through this occupation. For most of us in the occupation who are just trying to keep things running and trying to escalate the struggle, our main concern is getting the workers a fair contract, mm-hmm. and getting them all their jobs back. I guess there's that. There's a general split down the occupation on that issue.
Yeah, and not to say that that isn't the main goal of the Maoists as well, but they definitely do, alongside that goal, have broader dreams for what their group can achieve.
Right.
I would assume that most people would as well, you know, across political tendencies. Just wanted to ask, is there a connection between the occupation at the new school and the teacher strike in terms of just energy or being inspired to take action? Is there anything there that kind of connects them?
I think labor organizing in general has been on the upswing in America, and that's affected stuff. Like, a lot of the people mobilized around the occupation I mentioned are also part of SENS UAW, the local union, which, I mean, we have our problems with union structures and all that, but generally there's been the sense that organizing workers is becoming more and more important in America, especially over the last year.
Well, if you've ever been to New York or seen a demonstration there, you know, if you just watched the stuff on May Day, you know that, I mean, New York is very policed. You know, what does this occupation say about, you know, kind of creating situations that are out of the control of the authorities, that put our own interests, you know, at the front and center and create something worth fighting for?
I mean, I think, well, I would agree that this space has sort of gestured to, like, an inkling of maybe, like, what another way of life would look like. I think I would also just interject maybe that I think that the administration, it's entirely within, they could pull out their guns at any time. Right. I mean, I think that it's a strategic choice on their part mm-hmm. to not repress this situation. And I think that actually what they're trying to do is to sort of allow the occupation to continue in the hopes that it will just sort of peter out with the end of the school year and that students will get tired. But I think that the 2008 occupation show that that's something that they could and would be entirely willing to do at any point, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, this does sound pessimistic, but I think what's really become clear to me through this process is, like, when I picture a liberated world, I don't see any room for an institution like a university yeah. in it. And so this occupation, which is happening not just in the belly of the beast that's New York, but also in the belly of the beast that's neoliberal, like, academia at the New School, proves to me, like, I mean, look, the DSA came in on, like, the second day and gave everybody a security training that taught them we need marshals at every action to ensure quote-unquote proper behavior. And so I think it's – the occupation hasn't been repressed because everybody has this fear of it being repressed and I think there's a lot of self-policing, especially around the way democratic consensus is reached through these general assemblies and committees. So if I were looking for radical action, maybe in New York, but probably not inside a school.
I mean, I think we've also mentioned that, I mean, the visible organizers of the occupation, at least, are almost entirely white. So I think, in my opinion, that plays a large part in the administration's response to this particular occupation, is that they don't see it as much of a threat, or they're more willing to sort of allow it to remain because it does have sort of a white representational face.
Well, with those, you know, really great criticisms in mind, where do you see these things, where do you see this going? Is there a way to deepen it or strengthen it, make it grow in a certain way? You know, both Unite Here and the campus have issued a statement that seems to be designed to make people think that it is over. At least this is what people on social media are saying. And I'm just curious, you know, your thoughts, you know, where does this go now that it's over a week into it?
Yeah, so I think that the first thing I want to interject there is that I think the occupation has led to some real victories, quote unquote victories so far. Initially, this was occupation that was mainly about trying to prevent these workers from getting fired in the first place. Since the occupation has started, the New School has agreed to rehire these workers with a union contract, and the occupation has been able to shift into focusing on sort of the more nitty-gritty of what that contract is actually going to look like. But I think that being said, the bottom line is the workers are asking us to continue this occupation until the contract is actually signed. And right now that it looks like we're going to do, but the administration, as a lot of us have seen, seems to be pretty fine about just letting the occupation continue until the school year so far. So I think that from that alone, it's here that in order to make this a good contract that is valuable for these workers and gives them some sense of livelihood, there do need to be some escalations in what this occupation looks like. And I think that's something that a lot of us are thinking about right now in the occupation, is how can we switch things up tactically as to put more pressure on the administration.
And just to clarify, the joint statement that Unite Here and the administration released doesn't meet, we know proof that meets the demands that the workers and the occupation have made together. And so we are going to stay unoccupied, and that's been the general sense. until we see a contract that's signed by all the workers.
Yeah, and just, I mean, just a thought about moving forward, I think that this moment that we're seeing now, wherein the academic student workers are going on strike, just presents a really incredible opportunity for us to sort of collaborate with each other and to forge connections that sort of draw attention to how these are not isolated issues, and this is actually, you know, the exploitation of workers within the university is like built into its very structure, and is like, you know, it's founded on that in many ways, or it can't sustain itself without that. So I think that, you know, now is, I think, a moment when a lot of the sense UAW people, as well as like the occupiers, are sort of together, just sharing this feeling that these struggles are like intimately connected and related to one another. And I think with that knowledge, we can really figure out ways to put pressure on the administration, and to figure out how to, you know, essentially unite over the demand that I think in a very basic way we both share, which is that we want a fair contract immediately.
For all workers on campus.
Yeah, for all the workers.
Well, just kind of thinking beyond this, I mean, we're at a point now, it seems in our estimation, that, you know, lots of things are popping off that, you know, a couple years ago before would have seemed that they wouldn't have been possible or very unlikely. You know, tens of thousands of workers going on wildcat strike across the country, you know, giving the finger to union bureaucrats that they're going to continue to strike and stuff like that. Kind of like, if this is the new normal, what do we need to be thinking about beyond that that would kind of like take us to another level?
That's a good question. I think it's like this occupation's really clarified that bureaucratic unions only exist within like this legalistic framework of the NLRB and cannot take actions outside of that framework and are fundamentally unwilling to take those actions even if they could. I think it also highlights the need for autonomous action, both like just all of the things that have pushed this occupation forward have come from people just getting up and doing them without any recourse to some sort of like respectable consensus or to any like legal framework. And so, yeah, I think that's where I'm coming from on this question. And I think that applies to unions in general in America.
I'd agree with that sentiment.
Well, anything else that you all want to talk about or add? You know, it's just awesome to see. I know that you all have some valid criticisms and analysis of what's going on. I think those are really insightful as well. But I think for people watching this, it's really cool to see people taking over a cafe and, you know, fighting for something valid, but also, you know, giving out free food along the way and stuff like that. But anything else you want to add just in terms of this struggle or any other insights that you've gained from it?
Yeah, I mean, as much as I have a lot of criticisms, and it's a lot of work to be in the space, and it can be really hard, especially as a person of color. Sometimes I just look around at like everything that we've done together and like the connections I've forged with people, and it is a beautiful thing, I think. And it shows that, I mean, I know I said it shows that like you can't have radical action in a university, but it shows that you can have radical action. You can get shit done.
Yeah.
I mean, within the limits of the university, we've still been able to achieve something that really is quite incredible, and so far has most importantly been quite successful.
And just to add another thing, I think the experience of seizing infrastructure, defending territory, and having each other's backs, that's been most important to me, and I think that this occupation has hopefully shown everybody involved that these are things that are possible, and that we can and we will keep doing these things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been really important to me to just sort of through like collective action and like I guess like to through collective action forge relationships with people that I I haven't really experienced before. And I think that maybe sound like, that might sound really banal or trivial or something, but I think that in the long run, like, it's super important. And that's like been one of the things that I guess I've been noticing most often, is sort of this how it coalesces, like the big picture, and then like, you know, every second of your day that you're involved in sort of planning these things and trying to execute them and in trying to further this struggle in any way that you can. And so the small scale and then the big picture of actually trying to have our demands met just sort of meet in this way that I think in the end just like sort of speaks to the importance of making friends, maybe.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Well, on that note of, I really liked that, the 3-point program. What was it? Seize infrastructure, defend territory, have each other's backs. That's great. Cafes today, tomorrow, the sewage treatment water facility.
And we actually have to deal with that a little bit too. There's been some.
Oh, really?
Smells coming out of the dishwashing room.
Oh, man. Yeah, learning all sorts of skills.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, you can follow the hashtag Occupy, what is it,
TNF.
The new school, but it's acronym.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Occupy TNS.
TNS, okay. Occupy TNS. Sounds like a really shitty cable news show or something. But follow that. There's several accounts. Also, I think Paper Tiger TV, which is a long-running independent media outlet, has been out there live tweeting a lot of stuff. Thanks so much for joining us. Any shout-outs, any send-offs before we end this?
Yeah, we won't stop until we have the president's head. That's what I have to say.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.